Thank you much, Mary. The gay Christians in Ireland in the 1970s and 1980s were like fairies. Like the fairies, most people in Ireland didn't believe they existed. Letters in the newspapers declared with certainty that you could not be gay and Christian. Like the fairies, the gay Christians were rarely seen in public. And like the fairies, the gay Christians existed mainly underground. 30 years ago, in 1989, I first discovered the gay Christians. At the time, I was a student at Queen's studying social anthropology. In anthropology, we were taught the method of participant observation. When I stumbled upon the gay Christians, I participated in their activities and I made some observations. What follows next are some of my observations. They began in spring 1989 when I started going out with my new Belfast boyfriend. I recall one afternoon when he said, "Would you like to come with me to a meeting of the Gay Christian Fellowship?" My immediate response to him was to say, "That sounds very Protestant." Naturally, I didn't agree to go to a meeting without asking some questions. I asked him, "Are all the gay Christians Protestant?" He replied, "No, Catholics attend too." That surprised me. My general observation in 1989 in Belfast was that Catholics and Protestants rarely engaged in joint religious activities. I asked him what the gay Christians believed in. He handed me a leaflet, this leaflet. The leaflet, in striking red colour, and printed on the front in large bold lettering are the words, "Christianity and Homosexuality. The Gay Christian Movement, with an address in London." And also stamped on the leaflet is "Gay Christian Fellowship with an address in Belfast." This leaflet is evidence that a local gay Christian group based in Northern Ireland had taken an information leaflet from a national gay Christian organisation and had stamped their material with their own local contact details. Just a word in terminology. I will be using the term gay and lesbian rather than LGBT or queer, as during the 1970s, gay and lesbian were the terms of description, the polite terms of description, typically adopted by individuals and organisations. This leaflet contains the following statements on beliefs. Most Christians have believed, and most churches have taught, that you cannot be Christian and express your love for another person of the same sex in a sexual relationship. But it is the conviction of the gay Christian movement that is entirely compatible with the Christian faith to love another person of the same sex. For its time in Northern Ireland, this was a new and radical gay-affirming message. My boyfriend also gave me a separate single-page information sheet, this sheet. On the top it reads, "Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality." I asked him why it was called the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality. He explained that this was the official name for the Gay Christian Fellowship. He added that Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality is a bit of a mouthful to say. So people began to refer to it by its initials, NICRH. He told me that it didn't take long for Belfast gays to see the humour in this by pronouncing these initials, NICRH, as knickers. Not surprisingly, knickers decided to adopt the less humorous name of Gay Christian Fellowship. However, during this talk, I will use the two names interchangeably, according to the usage in the archive of documents I am drawing on. And sometimes the Gay Christian Fellowship is referred to by its initials, GCF. On the information sheet is written a programme of activities for the group. The programme for 1989 includes 29th of February, Two's Company, whatever that's about. 12th to the 14th of May, Weekend Away, more about that later. But it was their event on the 19th of March 1989 that I was about to attend. On the programme, it is described by the team, "Farewell to X." Well, I'm saying X rather than the actual name written. Indeed, the program leaflet is signed by X, who doesn't provide a surname. I asked my boyfriend, who's X? He replied that X was a gay clergy person. I asked him, did the church know that X was gay? My boyfriend answered, probably not, at least not officially, and that if his church found out, he'd be thrown out of ministry. This was my first discovery about the faithful underground, that it included gay clergy, and that to survive, they needed to be discreet. The location of that first meeting I attended was at 8 Upper Crescent, off University Road. This is about 3 minutes' walk from here. This was a premises owned by the Coromila community. I only knew of the Coromila community as a faith-based organisation in Northern Ireland that unusually worked with both Catholics and Protestants. I must admit, my preconception of the Gay Christian Fellowship was that it might be made up of holy Joes. Well, I was wrong in the first count. It was not made up of holies. To give you a sense of the type of people who were there, I can show you a cartoon. It's a cartoon from the front cover of the magazine of the National Gay Christian Movement. The front cover from 1982 depicts two gay Christian men, which I... Obviously, that's not there. This is there. The caption underneath the drawing is in rather small print, so I'll read out loud. How about coming back to my place for a little Christianity? Social tolerance and homosexuality. I think this cartoon captures well the wide range of activities of the Gay Christian Fellowship. The activities range from spirituality to the educational to the social activity of enjoyment and meeting other gay men. At the meeting, one man told me he was a librarian at Queen's. You probably know. But he's not here anymore. Another man said he was a church organist. The church organist told me that if it became known in his Catholic church that he was gay, he would be sacked. Those in attendance may not all have been holy, but they were all Joes. I didn't meet any women at the meetings, so where were the women? My boyfriend informed me that his friend Sylvia Sands, who was heterosexual and female, was once an early chairperson of the Gay Christian Fellowship. Here's a picture of Sylvia. Sylvia was unusual in that she was a straight Christian ally of gay people. She came over from London, Cockney accent, worked with the loyalist Tartan gangs, got to know some gays, and straight Christian allies in the 1970s in Northern Ireland were extremely rare. On this question of gender, I've learned that in the Republic of Ireland and in Britain and the USA, the gay Christian movement was also very heavily made up of men. And maybe in discussion we can talk more about why women weren't drawn to this movement. As part of my subsequent research and interest in this question, I've examined minutes of a committee meeting of the Gay Christian Fellowship. And in the committee meeting minutes, one of the items reads as follows. Lack of women in Gay Christian Fellowship. Decision. Try very hard to attract them. So at least there is written evidence that these gay Christians said they had a desire to try very hard to attract women. Even in practice, they were not very successful in doing so. Now, about that weekend away, mentioned on the programme. The weekend retreat was held at the Coromila community in Ballycastle County, Antrim. The Coromila community seemed to have been the first and initially the only Christian organisation in Northern Ireland that welcomed persons who were gay. At that time, practically all other Christian organisations were homophobic. I'm going to pause there because I see someone standing and I've got a spare chair so they can take it. I was present at that retreat in 1989, and here's one of the photos I took of the participants that weekend at Coromila. Some of you might recognise the cross in Coromila. I mean, I have other photos. swans which are close up, but this photo is shot at mid-distance and it doesn't show the men's faces, as many of those present were not out to their families. The Gay Christian Fellowship meetings and weekend retreat felt to me a bit like an underground society. That's why I've termed them the Faithful Underground. This was understandable, as some of the men present had much to lose if it was known that they were involved in a gay Christian group. It's worth remembering that this was only 7 years after 1982, when same-sex relationships between men had been decriminalised in Northern Ireland. This may explain why my own boyfriend, although out on gay scene, was not out at work. I have a photograph from December 1989 of the two of us at my graduation ceremony at Queen's. Okay, the photograph is a bit blurry, so I'm not going to project on a big screen, but I can tell you, there I am on the left, looking really young and smart, and there he is on the right. And although it was winter, it is notable that he is wearing a blue scarf wrapped tightly around his neck. And the reason he's wearing a scarf is that without it, it was visible to others that he was wearing a clerical collar. Because my new boyfriend was a serving clergyman in the Church of Ireland. His full name was the Reverend Mervyn Kingston. So by entering a relationship with a clergyman, I was thrown in at the deep end into the Faithful Underground. After that bit of oral history, I want to move on 20 years. By 2009, I was at Queen's, this time as a lecturer in sociology. And in that year, I published a chapter in a book edited by Stephen Hunt called Contemporary Christianity and LGBT Sexualities. And in it, I wrote a chapter titled Christians and Gays in Northern Ireland, How the Ethno-Religious Context Has Shaped Christian Anti-Gay and Pro-Gay Activism. In that chapter, I wrote that Northern Ireland, in contrast to the rest of the UK, does not have a history of visible gay Christian groups. Until 2007, with the foundation of Changing Attitude Ireland, we can only trace the foundation of a few small, largely non-public Christian groups. The most significant of these were the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Sexuality, Gay Christian Fellowship. I have since revised that opinion. There was a more significant gay Christian movement in Northern Ireland than I had realised. What is lacking is a history of that gay Christian movement. It wasn't just that the public visibility of gay Christians was restricted, for understandable reasons, but the visibility of sociologists and historians was also restricted, in that we didn't know where to look. Among the archival documents on LGBT history in the Public Records Office of Northern Ireland, there are some references to gay Christians, but these can be difficult to make sense of for reasons which will become clear over the course of this talk. It was only with the death in 2013 of my partner, Mervyn Kingston, that I discovered that the most valuable archive on the Faithful Underground was in my own attic. Because Mervyn had been involved in the Gay Christian Fellowship since 1981, he is probably the individual with the longest sustained involvement. So what did I find in the attic about the Faithful Underground? Among my archival material is a copy of a booklet published by the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality. This booklet is called Dialogue. There's a Christian cross on the cover. This booklet is dated 1977. On the inside cover, it states, "The Council is a group of people who came together early in 1976 to investigate the problems arising from religion in relation to homosexuality. The Council seeks to inform the homosexual community, the churches and society in general, that there need not necessarily be a conflict between one's faith and one's sexual orientation. In pursuing this objective, the Council meets regularly to A. establish liaison with the churches and society, and B. provide help to those whose sexual orientation has given rise to religious conflict resulting in the breaking of religious affiliation." So So we find that the publication dialogue emphasizes the educational work of the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Sexuality, Gay Christian Fellowship, and this was happening as early as the 1970s. I've seen other archival documents which emphasize the activities of shared religious worship. In a letter 9 years later, dated the 6th of February 1986, from the Reverend Mervyn Kingston to the Reverend Richard Kirker, the head of the lesbian and gay Christian movement nationally in London, Mervyn says of the GCF, "We try to avoid the religious meeting approach and offer a varied programme of discussion and friendship. This reference to the importance of discussion and friendship is consistent with the discussion and social activities I observed myself in 1989. From conversations with some of the pioneers of our Northern Ireland gay rights movement, notably Jeff Dudgeon, who's here in the audience, and Brian Gilmore, who's here in the audience, I clarified that the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality was co-founded in 1976 by Michael Workman and a handful of others. I viewed the setting up of the group as part of an international development, the emergence of a gay Christian movement that happened in Britain, in Europe, the United States. But I think it's remarkable that a gay Christian organisation was established so early in homophobic Northern Ireland. It is indicative of both the presence of individual Christians among the gay activists and the realisation within the wider gay political movement that they couldn't simply ignore religion and the churches. In this booklet, there's an opening article. It's noteworthy that it is not signed. It is just initialed by the president, PBK. Presumably PBK felt it was necessary to deliberately use only initials, it being too dangerous for them to be visible. PBK writes about the Council on Religion and Homosexuality's enormous battle against ignorance, fear and prejudice, and concludes that we in the Council, for our part, realise that it will take many years to change these attitudes. So PBK wrote that 42 years ago, that it will take many years to change these attitudes, and many of us in this room today realise that he knew how long and difficult that road would be. The next article is on homosexuality and the natural law. It's a theological piece, and it is simply signed anonymous. On page 7, there was one of only two named contributors in the entire pamphlet, one being the name of Michael Workman. Michael wrote a piece called Love, A Basic for Ethics, and I quote, "Sex is not a dirty or filthy thing. It is not something to be avoided or to be shunned in its proper context. Rather, it is a wonderful gift from God which helps to complement and express love." On page 5, there is a second name, that of Bill Wilson. Bill describes himself as a homosexual Christian, and he is the author of an article called In Love, There Is No Conflict. 42 years ago, Bill wrote, in my best Belfast accent, "I am patiently waiting at the inner door of the Christian church where I seek the bread of social justice. But I have either been altogether ignored or told to wait until later. Some of the custodians have a heartfelt desire to open the door and provide the bread, but they are more cautious than courageous and more prone to follow the expedient rather than the love ethic of Jesus Christ." That's what a gay Presbyterian in Belfast 42 years ago wrote about his church. He could equally have written the same about the Presbyterian church in 2019. Bill was a Presbyterian. He attended his local Presbyterian church and was a church organist. I have been told that the first meeting of the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality took place at Bill Wilson's house in Gilnahert in East Belfast. Bill Wilson, Mike Woodman, Sylvia Sands in the 1970s, are the earliest pioneers of the local LGBT Christian movement. To remind you of the context in which they were writing and were visible, in Northern Ireland, same-sex relations between men were criminal until 1982. The Christian churches in the 1970s did not agree on whether homosexuality should continue to be a crime. The leadership of the Presbyterian Church wanted it to continue to be criminal, as did the Catholic leader, Cardinal Tomaso Fee. The leaderships of the Church of Ireland and the Methodist Church supported decriminalisation. In 1977, the Reverend Ian Paisley of the Free Presbyterian Church and the Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, led a campaign to save Ulster from sodomy. Have a cartoon of the period which depicts the Protestant leader, the Reverend Ian Paisley. Okay, this was meant to be up on the slide, but for glitch it's not, so I'm going to have to act it out. Okay, so on the right, there's Reverend Ian Paisley, and above his head, there's Save Ulster from Sodomy. And on the left, there's Cardinal Tomaso Fee, Catholics know the gay law reform. And in the middle, there's a sign saying, more gay suicides in Ireland. And above, there's at last, a united Ireland. So, you know, cartoons can call it as it is. Coincidentally, 4 decades later, today, the 21st of October, is the day legislation for marriage equality in Northern Ireland is due to come into effect, despite the joint opposition of both the DUP and the bishops of the Catholic Church. That view of the cartoons of the effects of Christian homophobia on the rate of gay suicide, which was already noted, 40 years ago, was written about by Sylvia Sands. Sylvia Sands wrote, "The majority of gay people who suffered breakdowns and committed suicide all seem to have been counselled by Christians of one shade or another." The early gay Christian movement engaged in various forms of activism. There was evidence of this in reports in Northern Ireland newspapers. For example, there's a newspaper report in the Northern Ireland newspaper, the Sunday News, of the 19th of June 1977. The headline is, "Gays to Meet Newman." I quote, "The Northern Ireland Gay Rights Association is to ask for a meeting with the Chief Constable of the Police, Kenneth Newman, to discuss allegations of harassment of homosexuals by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. The decision to send a deputation to meet the Chief Constable was taken at the Northern Ireland Gay Rights Association annual general meeting in Belfast this weekend. Delegates included men and women from the Gay Liberation Society, Coleraine Sexual Reform Movement, and the Northern Ireland Council on Religion and Homosexuality. Note that the radical secular activist group, the Gay Liberation Society, and the Gay Christian group are cooperating publicly on the issue of challenging police harassment of gay men. This is not to deny that there were some objections to gay Christians by secular gay activists. Here is one example from the newsletter of the Northern Ireland Gay Rights Newsletter of 1977. It's an opinion by the gay male activist John Little, entitled The Gospel of Liberation. John Little writes, "I find myself and others more than a bit pissed off by the impossible mixture of gayness and religion. There is a conflict between being gay and Christian. You can be one or the other, but not both. The two clash, logically speaking, and must ultimately, one must wipe out the other." However, what I've found so far in the archives indicates cooperation and generally good relations between the secular gay rights organisations and the gay Christian organisation, and sometimes even an overlap in membership. Perhaps this is more likely in a small place like Northern Ireland, with a smaller gay community, where cooperation is more possible out of necessity. The historian Patrick McDonagh, in his journal article, "Homosexuals Are Revolting, Gay and Lesbian Activism in the Republic of Ireland, 1970s to 1990s, Dr. McDullough helpfully turns our attention away from the focus on the legal campaign for decriminalisation and onto, and I quote, multiple forms of resistance. He refers to, and I quote, the role of activists in beginning a dialogue around homosexuality which helped to win over Irish society. Following on from McDonagh, I view gay Christian activism as one of these multiple forms of resistance, and one which needs to be part of the more complete story of what McDonagh calls beginning a dialogue around homosexuality which helped win over Irish society. Here's an extract from a letter from the convener of the Gay Christian Fellowship, published in the Belfast Telegraph in 1985. I quote, "The Church of Ireland's perception of homosexuality is minimal. Church bookshops do not stock even such basic material as the leaflet Understanding Homosexuality, produced by the Mothers' Union in England. We hope to combat the hostility by some Christians towards gay women and men by education. We can do this by suggesting a suitable bibliography for those interested and by offering speakers for groups." Signed by the convener, Gay Christian Fellowship, P.O. Box 44 Belfast, which is actually the same address as the secular gay organisations. This letter is not just of interest because it provides evidence of the activism of the Gay Christian Fellowship. It also illustrates the restrictions under which gay Christians had to operate. I have discovered that the name used by the author is a pseudonym. I now know that the writer of the letter, the convener of the GCF, at that time was a Church of Ireland clergyman, my own late partner, the Reverend Bernard Kingston. Presumably he was concerned he could be dismissed from his parish post if he used his real name. The response to this letter from the Gay Christian Fellowship was typically an opposing, homophobic letter, and the one I'm referring to here, whose author was satisfied to be named. The author of the opposing letter complains that the previous writer, and I quote, uses the term Christian in close proximity with what he calls gayness or homosexuality. He criticised the Church of Ireland for its minimal perception of sodomy. I prefer the proper scriptural term, if I may be permitted to use it. And church bookshops for not stocking books whose contents will endeavour to make the revolting practice seem morally acceptable. It is a matter of men and women being reconciled to God, not, as the writer states, trying to help people reconcile perverted sexuality with religion. That the best-selling Northern Ireland newspaper, the Belfast Telegraph, was willing to publish letters reducing homosexuality to sodomy shows how widely disseminated were homophobic messages. These letters are illustrative of the hostile environment in which the faithful on the ground had to operate. Another form of resistance can be the cartoon. This next example is from the Republic of Ireland, and this will allow me to say something about gay Christian activism in the South, which for constraints of time I have not yet spoken about. It's a cartoon published in a Church of Ireland youth magazine in Dublin in 1980. The magazine states, "The views and opinions expressed in this magazine are those of individuals and do not necessarily coincide with those of the Diocesan Youth Council of the Church of Ireland." However, the editor slipped in the following cartoon. On the left are some tall, large human figures with clerical collars and large crosses dangling on their chests. These are the bishops. And on the other side are these smaller figures, looking a bit down, with badges GLF, that's the Gay Liberation Front, and CHE, that's Campaign for Homosexual Equality, Law Reform. And the bishops are saying, "We know God is love, but we don't have to love your son." I mean, I think this is indicative of how in the early years, people, in this case an editor who was sympathetic to the case of law reform and better treatment for LGBT, you know, used the cartoon to maybe provoke some talk about it. And note that this cartoon, of course, is in a faith publication, so it's less likely to make it into an LGBT archive, which is one reason why in this area of research we need to look wider than LGBT archive material. I will continue with some of my own account as an observer participant in 1990 of the Gay Christians. The organisational development of gay Christian activism in the Republic of Ireland in the 1970s and 80s was different to that which happened in Northern Ireland. The religious composition was different in the South, which was overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. And also gay groups in the North were in closer contact with Britain. In the 1970s and 1980s in the South, a gay Christian group existed called REACH. In 1990, the Gay Christian Fellowship in the North and REACH in the South jointly applied for a grant from Cooperation North. Cooperation North was a North-South peace charity which became Cooperation Ireland. Its purpose was to encourage friendly cross-border North-South exchanges between community groups. And Cooperation North received some funding from the Irish government. There is irony in the fact that the Irish government in 1990 indirectly funded gay Christian men to have a weekend retreat, myself and my partner included, while until 1993, it still treated same-sex relationships as criminal. That Cooperation North funded gay Christian retreat was 29 years ago, on the weekend of the 21st and 23rd of May 1990. The location was Ross Trevor, County Down. Mervyn took a photo of the Northern Ireland Gay Christian Fellowship and the Southern Christian REACH group. A photo of us all together enjoying a picnic, a fairy picnic. I have a photo which I'm in it. I'm next to the picnic basket, presumably with fairy cakes. And in the centre, stretched out in the grass, is Michael. Michael was the leader of the Southern Fairies. And next to me is a fairy who I won't name because he was married and closeted. So I won't project onto the big screen this remarkable photo of that fairy picnic, because it may not still be safe for all those fairies to be identified in public. But here is a copy of the programme for the weekend retreat. It includes Saturday, workshop, coming out to family, afternoon, coming out to church, Sunday, service of Holy Communion. This is the service sheet for the Holy Communion service. The Holy Communion was according to the rite of the Church of Ireland. The gay men, Catholic and Protestant, took Holy Communion. They did so knowing that the Catholic Church and most of the Protestant churches disapprove of Catholics and Protestants taking Holy Communion together. The presiding clergyman at the service was the Reverend Mervyn Kingston. Some of us knew that if this religious service to gay people became public, he would very likely be sanctioned by the Church of Ireland. This is what resistance looks like. Yeah. That day before that shared Holy Communion by Catholic and Protestant gay men, Colin McCarville was shot dead at Loch Ness by the IRA. The day of that Holy Communion, William McAllister was shot dead in County Down by the UDA. One of the advantages of activism in earlier life is that one can visit the archives and possibly see someone else's written record of your own earlier life activities. In the Irish Queer Archive in the National Library Dublin, I read this report submitted to Cooperation North summarising that same weekend retreat in 1990. The report on Cooperation North Exchange describes, I quote, "The two groups, REACH, and the Gay Christian Fellowship, while both being Christian in nature, work quite differently in practice. This may be due to the difference in size, the Southern group being larger, or the fact that religion tends not to be such a divisive issue in the South. From each members who had previously taken religious tolerance for granted, meeting with members of the Northern Gay Christian Fellowship was invaluable in fostering a greater understanding of the differences separating people. It appeared that the Gay Christian Fellowship had managed to overcome those differences, perhaps through concentrating on the similarities between people who were gay. In conclusion, I'd like to raise some points about the challenges when doing this type of hidden history. Firstly, historical scholarship on LGBT activism in Ireland, especially the key decade of the 1970s when the gay rights movement took off, has largely ignored the role and contribution of LGBT Christians and pro-LGBT Christian individuals and organisations. Therefore, there is a reduced literature to draw on. Secondly, historians may not have been looking for it, perhaps because of an assumption that the gay rights movement would be secular and possibly even anti-religious. As I've tried to demonstrate above, the gay rights movement in Northern Ireland does not appear to have been anti-religious. Indeed, there is some evidence of cooperation between secular and the gay Christian groups. Thirdly, as I've tried to demonstrate above, much of gay Christian activism was of necessity discreet, hence my use of the term the faithful underground. This is evident in the deliberate use of initials, even in publications, the use of first names only, the use of pseudonyms in letter writing to hide true identities. This precaution was of necessity. However, it means that these activists, pioneers in their time, are less traceable by historians and so risk being admitted from accounts of queer history. Fourthly, some of the surviving documentary evidence is not to be found in LGBT archives but is in church archives, and church archives are not readily available on all areas of the subject. Fifthly, my attempt to begin to write a history of gay Christian activism in Ireland is unavoidably also autobiographical history. I have included my own oral history account based on my observations in 1989-90 as an observer participant. I am being open that my main source of documentary material is that which I have inherited from my late activist partner. I realise that in historical research and writing, this is unconventional. This poses a methodological challenge. How do we incorporate it? The I in history. How do we harness the insider knowledge of the author, especially when trying to tell the histories of elusive subjects such as the faithful underground? I'm also reminded of Walter Benjamin's comments on the writing of history being based on fragments and ephemera. The writing of the history of the faithful underground may well be dependent on fragments and ephemera. For example, the ordinary photograph of a man at a graduation ceremony wearing a blue scarf, the insider knowledge of which unlocks a hidden story. All the above challenges may explain in part why this area of gay activism had been relatively neglected in the historical writing. Finally, may I remind you that the faithful underground still exist. As recently as 2012, when I co-edited a volume called Moving Forward Together, Homosexuality and the Church of Ireland, a gay couple called Henry and Charles told me their story. Those are not their real names, Henry and Charles. Even in 2012, they felt they could not use their real names or they would be punished by the church. Such fears are not unfounded. Earlier this month, in October 2019, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland punished a Presbyterian elder in Dublin when it learned he was in a same-sex partnership. The history of the faithful underground in Ireland is still being made. Thank you.